This is the ARC Energy Ideas Podcast with Peter Terzakian and Jackie Forrest, exploring trends that influence the energy business.
Welcome to the ARC Energy Ideas Podcast for November 12th, 2019. I'm Peter Terzakian.
And I'm Jackie Forrest. Lots of things have been happening in the world of oil and gas, So we wanted to talk about a number of things. First of all, there's been just a tsunami of Q3 results coming at
us. It's that time of year.
Yeah, and we wanted to talk about some of the big themes from oil and gas producers and service companies that are coming out of those results, And also maybe what it means for next year. Saudi Aramco is going forward with this long-awaited IPO.
The biggest in the world.
Yeah, so what's the pitch? I've had the pleasure of reading the 653-page prospectus.
Yeah.
I have to admit, I did skim parts of it, but I got the gist of it. And lastly, we want to talk about the numerous headlines that we've been seeing about a slowdown for U.S. oil production growth, what they're saying, and maybe what is not being said that I think's in there as well.
Like places like the Permian and so on.
Yeah, in the U.S. for sure.
Okay.
And so let's start with number one.
Number one is the oil and gas producers, their quarterly results, the service firms. So what are they saying?
First of all, I want to give a special thanks to Patrick Bryden at Scotiabank Equities Research. Him and the team there helped us with distilling some of the big themes that were coming out, because there's just a lot of companies reporting.
And he's been on our show before.
And he has, yeah. And I gave him a call and said, you know, what are the big themes? Well, let's talk about the E&P companies first, and then we'll talk about the oilfield service firms. So, you know, it's the same themes we've been talking about. So it's really just a validation that the companies out there are changing in terms of their focus. So there's basically a focus on reduced CapEx budgets, moderated production growth, getting free cash flow, being more profitable. So you're seeing that come out in a lot of the company results.
So there's the investors have been driving the companies. The companies have been adapting to this idea that don't grow production. We don't need any more oil and gas. We are in a world where we want you to grow your profitability and give us some money back.
Right. And it even some signaling that although there's been a lot of buybacks of shares this year and dividend payments, that those may even increase as we think into next year. So some announcements like that. The other thing that's interesting is we are starting to get some visibility on capital spending for Canada for 2020. Our last podcast, we talked about the fiscal pulse, that our model that ARC has that looks at the amount of money coming out of the industry in terms of revenue, how much goes to expenses and how much cash flow is left. And we basically said, you know, we think that all things the same, if price stays low and people continue to prioritize shareholder payments, then we can't expect activity levels to be any higher than 2019 and maybe even a little bit lower as we look into 2020. So we started to get some examples of that. We've had six companies in Canada give guidance for 2020 spending right now. And it's everything from no change compared to 2019 to 30% lower. And of the six companies, on average, about 12% less spending.
Yeah. So let's take a look at that. So the industry is going to generate roughly, I'm just throw out the numbers from the last podcast, about $110, $115 billion in revenue. Out of that, there's $50 billion in cash flow. Historically, that $50 billion would have been amped up with another $15 from debt, equity, and so on to make $65. But that's gone to zero, so we're back at 50. And not only that, the investors are saying, give me my money back with share buybacks or dividends. In fact, that 50 now turns to 30.
That's right, in 2019.
In 2019. And now you're saying in 2020 that 30 could be potentially even less.
Not like 10% less.
Notwithstanding if, I mean, the oil prices have been a little bit stronger as of the gas prices.
Gas prices have been stronger, but, you know, we averaged about $57 US WTI so far this year. And if you look at the futures, it would be lower than that. But yeah, for sure, oil price matters. But I also think the guidance that these public companies put out matters, because often if they say they're going to spend so much money next year, regardless of price, unless price goes really down, they will spend it. And so, you know, 12% down. Of course, this is only six companies, like it's early days, but I think it's a good indication of where we felt things were going. And interestingly enough, the Scotia team came to the same conclusion independently, that they felt that based on what they've learned so far, that they're expecting next year to be softer. So it's tough because we're already down 30% year on year this year. And then lower activity levels even next year.
Right.
It looks like it's going to be a bit of a tough year next year. And that leads me into oil field services, which is the other group of companies that have been putting out their quarterly results. And the message here is right-sizing and adjusting to the new environment. So a lot of talk about removing equipment from the fleet. Schlumberger actually announced that they're having a strategic review of their North American land market operations. So we may see more equipment removed as part of that. So really right-sizing the industry for this lower activity
level. Right-sizing the industry for level to only modestly growing production. And that's not only a Canadian thing. It's also, as you said, North American, so it's American as well.
Oh, definitely. Yeah, definitely the service industry in the United States is the one that's actually talking about. I mean, there's even cases of removing, not just parking the equipment, but actually cutting it up. So it seems like a shrinking of the oil field service. Mm-hmm. The other message is not much clarity on next year. Most saying that they're envisioning flat activity. But I would just say, based on some of these early results here, maybe seeing a decline. And I would say that's happening in the U.S. as well. Most outlooks are for next year to have lower activity levels potentially in the U.S. than we've had on average. Right. So far this year.
And that could have implications to their production growth, which we'll talk about in a few minutes. But first of all, I want to talk about the Saudi Aramco IPO.
Yeah. So this, first of all, it's a very big deal. You know, for those that kind of, just to put it in numbers, this is arguably the most valuable company in the world. Its net income last year was $111 billion. That's the net income.
Mm-hmm.
And Apple was about half this, which is deemed to be the most profitable company in the world. So this, you know, getting a piece of this company is interesting for a lot of people because of the profit and the large magnitude of the company.
It's gigantic. It supplies 10% of the world's oil needs. And it's got some of the lowest cost oil in the world, which the prospectus shamelessly talks about. It's a very profitable company. It's largest in the world. They've been talking about going public to be able to monetize some of the company to help pay for their diversification in the country. How much are they raising?
Well, that is debatable because we're not sure how many shares or what percentage of the company will actually be sold. But many estimates peg it at over $25 billion, maybe even as high as $30 billion is what they want to raise. People are coming to that because they feel like this should be the world's largest IPO, that Saudi Aramco would want to have that recognition as having the world's largest IPO. The biggest ever before this was Alibaba. That was that big Chinese online retailer at $25 billion in 2014. And most expect that they're going to want to be larger than that. You know, another big change this has is, you know, Saudi Aramco, for the history of my whole career, has been just clouded in secrecy, right? Everything about it was secret. And, you know, now the company's going from secrecy to transparency. I mean, in the past, like, people literally made a living trying to predict some of the stuff that's now in the prospectus that is just for everybody to read. So I think that, you know, it was is another big change in the oil markets. Here we have a company that we never really could understand or predict.
Right.
And now we're going to get a lot more transparency.
Well, people forget that I think it's something like 80% of the world's oil is under the control of state companies, like national oil companies. And most of them are very opaque. And certainly the Saudis were very cautious about being public with their numbers and the reserves and all that kind of stuff. And so if you're going to go public, as the name implies, public means you have to be more transparent. And the prospectus is, I don't know, what, 600 and some pages. There's a lot of disclosure there.
Yeah.
And it's very interesting because it also sets the benchmark for the arguably lowest cost producer in the world, or one of the lowest cost producers in the world. And that's important to understand if going into future decades of oil consumption, it's going to be the low cost producers that the one will be the last barrels to be consumed. And Saudis are going to be one of them.
Yeah. And we always kind of knew that inherently. A lot of people viewed that Saudi had very cheap oil, but that is definitely part of the pitch. And there's some numbers there. Before we go on to the pitch, I just wanted to talk, you know, another big thing why this is a big deal is we have not had too many IPOs in the oil and gas industry in the last 4 or 5 years. And so, you know, it'll test, do investors still have appetite for oil and gas? I mean, you're getting the crown jewels here in terms of getting into Saudi Aramco, but there has been a lot of frustration with oil and gas investing over the last 4 or 5 years. And will there be the appetite for
capital? There will be the appetite because this is a highly profitable company. The investment adage when you look at what premium companies to invest in is invest in the lowest cost producer and the dominant company in a space, right? Whether it's retail or real estate or whatever. Mm-hmm. This is definitely one of the premium companies in the space, if not the premium company. So I expect that you are going to see them raise the money, but it will depend upon the valuation. And they were hoping to get a $2 trillion valuation, which is sort of a mind-boggling amount. We don't know. It's going to be priced on December 5th. And the amount that they're going to offer, what percentage of the company is going to come out at that time too. If they can't agree, if the price, if it's too low, which I kind of suspect it won't be, I think they're going to get a decent valuation. It's not going to be $2 trillion, but I'd suggest it's going to be 1.5 plus. And if that's the case, I think they'll be successful.
Yeah. Okay. Well, we'll wait and see. We'll probably revisit the end of the year, but let's talk about their pitch because it is compelling. And, you know, there's been other articles as well. I wanted to comment about an Economist article a couple of weeks ago. It was the cover of The Economist called To the Last Drop, Saudi's Strategy to Survive the End of Oil.
Yeah, and that's just ridiculous. But anyway, carry on.
And the prospectus kind of had that similar theme. It talked about the fact that they're low cost, $2.80 per barrel lifting costs.
U.S.
They talked about that's so much lower than all the super majors. And they had some charts in there to show that as well. And they also showed some data that said their break even for new oil projects, and there's a range, but a lot of potential at below $20 per barrel Brent price full cycle with a 10% return, they could actually provide value to their shareholders at that type of price level. Mm-hmm. And they had this chart that showed a whole bunch of other supply in the world, all more expensive than them. And so that's really part of what they're trying to say is, yeah, there may be uncertainty about the price of oil or demand, but being that we are the lowest cost source of supply, like you said, then we should be there to the very, to the
last
end,
drop.
To the last drop, like the Economist article said.
Yeah. Well, I think that the Economist article is a little bit dramatic in this whole end of oil thing. It's going to take decades. And Saudi will definitely be one of the producers that will endure going forward. But the notion that there won't be others amongst them, even our own basin over here, is not on, because the Western world is innovating to drive down their costs. I don't know how many times we've talked about that on our podcast. And the ones that are most at risk in a world where oil consumption starts to go down are the most expensive barrels in the world, the most encumbered barrels in the world from many dimensions. And if you look at the high end, there's lots of those.
Right. Yeah, they have sources of supply, I mean, that are in the range of $70 plus per barrel break-even costs to be developed.
Yeah, right? Although, you know, even some of these numbers, I mean, look at the error bars on them. They're just so wide. And, you know, what that cost curve also tells you is that the marginal cost, in other words, the cost of bringing the last barrel out of the ground that's demanded, is actually quite high. You know, it's not $30. It's not $40. I mean, that would suggest that it's $70 now. That's full cycle, as they call it. In other words, if you are going to go and freshly drill up new fields.
And build all the infrastructure.
And bring all the infrastructure,
roads, the
right.
pipes, the
processing
facility.
But if you have
the
infrastructure, and certainly in places like Western Canada, where we do have now a lot of infrastructure, this cost curve is not an accurate representation of what's going on in the world.
Right. If you want to just stay at your existing production level, it's a lot right. lower because you have all that right. infrastructure. Now, another big part of the sales pitch is the low carbon. We've been talking about that a lot here on the podcast and for a long time. They believe that to be an oil supply source of the future, you need to be low carbon, and they are among the lowest carbon in the world. Then they show that Stanford research, the one I keep talking about.
Yeah.
The Stanford stuff shows Canada is very high carbon, and they even had a chart there that showed Canada is high carbon. They had Saudi Arabia at 5 grams of CO2 equivalent per megajoule, and Canada at like higher than 15. So 3 times more carbon for every barrel produced
right.
from Canada compared to Saudi Arabia.
But that data is old.
It is old. It doesn't represent some of the newest oil sands.
This is a whole separate subject. We've talked about it on the podcast, and we got to talk about it some more. It is incumbent upon our industry to change that number because it reflects like what, 2012? I don't know. Like it's,
well,
it's,
yeah, I mean, these are some of the older oil sands operations. It doesn't reflect the new mining right. operations that right. Are lower carbon. I know there's work going on right now led by Alberta Innovates that is working on improving right. those models, but it's crazy how this particular study pops up everywhere.
It does.
And those numbers being wrong have created a branding for the Canadian
oil industry.
A negative branding,
yeah. And the people like the Saudis and others use it at every opportunity to say, we're clean, they're dirty. I don't debate, actually, the Saudi numbers. It's light oil. You basically punch a shallow hole in the ground and the stuff comes flowing out of the ground. Mm-hmm. It's been that way for decades and decades. So it's cheap and it's low carbon. Doesn't really have to be processed as much as other types of oils around the world. But it's interesting the way they're positioning themselves as sort of like
And
they're doing a masterful job at promoting themselves as the premier low-cost, low-carbon supplier of the future.
Well, and here's the other benefit that they talk about, dividends in all parts of the oil price cycle. Because you're so low cost, even when oil prices get very low, you can still provide a return to your investors. And so that's part of the pitch as well. Now, I still think there's a risk for investors here. I mean, this isn't a normal company.
No.
The vast, vast majority will be owned by the government of Saudi Arabia. And if you go back and look in the prospectus and you look back before 2017, there wasn't a lot of net income, actually, because the government income tax was taking all the money from the company. At that point, they paid 85% tax.
Yeah.
That was been reduced to 50% in preparation for the IPO. But there is a concern if prices get really bad and the government doesn't have much money, they're the majority shareholder, they could just increase the taxes.
And I was tuned in, by the way, to the royalty line too. The royalties are 15 to 20% ballpark. So on top of the taxes, they have quite a bit of royalties as well. Because, you know, this is the social dividend that the company has to pay to the state. The type of dividends that are paid from Western companies are to shareholders. So now they have to pay the dividends to the state as well as to shareholders.
Yeah. So it's a unique risk for investors here that the things in the government can change and the government take.
What about the security risk?
Yeah. And then actually they had a whole list of risks. And one of them was geopolitical risk in the Middle East. And obviously we saw that with the Abqaiq outage this fall, that that's a real concern. I want to talk about demand. So they did address, like everyone who's trying to raise money in the oil and gas industry today, what their business would look like in different demand scenarios. Now, their base case was that oil demand grows about 0.8% per year from now to 2030 to reach about 108 million barrels a day of oil demand. They did assume that oil demand would level off about 2035. So that's their base case. And in that case, they actually increased from about 10% market share to 15%.
I wouldn't debate that. That's not an unreasonable scenario. But you know, I say, like, okay, let's just say peak demand comes a lot earlier and falls off a lot steeper, say to 90 million barrels a day or 80 million barrels per day. Saudi Arabia, Saudi Aramco produces what, like 9 or 10 million?
Yes.
Like there's still another 70, 80 million barrels on top of what they produce. In other words.
Yeah. So they're still going to be a player. So it's interesting. They did acknowledge that if there was a lower demand scenario, a scenario where oil demand would drop to about 80 million barrels a day by 2040, 2050, they actually still envision that they would have almost the same market share, not too much different production level. Okay, if you want to do that, you're going to have to flood the market with oil, right? To increase your market share in that low price scenario. So, but that's what they show. I think there would be some price implications to that scenario if they wanted to keep that much market share.
Sure. And what's their ESG narrative?
Well, you know, the ESG is really all about the E and how low carbon they are. But governance is another issue. When you read the prospectus, they talk about the board of directors that's assigned by the government. No input from shareholders here. They have a long list of people and they have a lot of information about each of the people there in the prospectus.
You know, I actually know one of them personally.
Oh,
I'm not going to say which one. So
okay.
I'm 0 degrees separated from this situation.
But, you know, this isn't your average company where the shareholders can have any say here on the company. They don't have a representative on the board or any ability to affect things at the company. So I think the governance side is a huge issue, the G. And of course, the social should be an issue for investors. This is a country that doesn't really have a good human rights record, cracks down on people that don't agree with them. Women activists have been jailed for speaking out for women's rights. You know, as we all know, they've been accused of killing a journalist that they did not agree with them. So I don't think they've got the social one covered either, which actually gets me thinking, you know, a lot of investors have signed up to care about ESG, right? This UNPRI investors that represent $89 trillion of assets under management who say they have to consider E, S, and G in their go-forward decisions. You know, could they invest in a company like this?
Probably not. I mean, I think that the scrutiny from the ESG departments and many of these big financial institutions, pension funds, and so on, I mean, now they have ESG scrutinizers, I'll call them. I don't think it would tick off a lot of boxes. But that doesn't mean, in my mind, that they're not going to be able to have a successful IPO, because there are many financiers around the world, even state governments like in China and other places, that are going to subscribe for this IPO, I'm pretty sure.
I think you're right.
There's been some interesting discussion, the notion that the price of oil potentially escalating and that the company is going to be well positioned, as opposed to the price falling because of the demand fall off.
Well, and that kind of speaks to this narrative that's been going on around slowdown for U.S. oil production, right? And we'll talk about it. There's been numerous news headlines, I would say, over the last 3 weeks or a month or so, talking about that shale oil growth is slowing down. And a big one that made a lot of news last week was IHS Markit projecting that shale oil growth will slow to 500,000 barrels a day in 2020 and then flatten after that. More growth.
So IHS Markit's a consultant in the arena that came out with a report that basically said, instead of growing over 1 million barrels per day as it did in the last couple of years.
Now,
right?
2019 will be 1 million barrels a day, but the year before that was like 1.8 million barrels a day.
Yeah. So it's actually going to start to be arrested to 500,000 barrels a day, what, this year or next year?
In 2020. And then it would flatten in 2021.
Out. Right.
But an important assumption in that is that assumes oil price averages around $50 in both those years.
Mm-hmm.
So at $50, no tight oil growth. So this is the part that doesn't get talked about. I think we've all known for a long time at $50 that U.S. tight oil wouldn't grow very much.
The rigs go home.
Yeah. A lot of outlooks before were assuming a higher oil price that had grown. Mm-hmm. So to me, it's not that surprising. If you're going to assume $50, you're not going to have a lot of growth out of
the U.S. Yeah, it doesn't surprise me. But getting back to the first part of our conversation today about the investor sentiments, basically saying no new equity, no new debt. And by the way, give me my money back and more dividends and buy back shares. That whole dynamic, regardless what the price is, that you are taking your cash flow and giving any free cash flow back to investors and none of it going back into the ground, that's independent of price.
Yes, that, well, price will give you a higher level of cash flow.
True.
But if you have to carve off, you know, 10-20% of that, then that's going to mean less investment.
Right, which ultimately would mean that the rigs go home because you're not investing back into the ground. The rigs go home. You basically allow declines to kick in and you're not replenishing fast enough. So you get this IHS outlook that you have flat.
Yeah. Yeah. They're not assuming a decline, but they're not assuming growth anymore. And they're not alone, by the way. There's been some shale oil cheerleaders that I think are helping out Saudi Arabia here, like Scott Sheffield from Pioneer, who actually said, I don't think OPEC has to worry that much about U.S. shale growth any longer term. And others like Mark Papa that talk about, you know, there isn't as much tier one resource.
So these are guys, the sort of the rock star CEOs from these big independent U.S. companies?
Yeah. I mean, Scott Sheffield from Pioneer was really the biggest cheerleader for U.S. shale oil, predicting wild growth over the past years. And
Mark he was Papa, right up to a point. Right. But now, as I said, things have shifted. The price is lower. Investors want their money back. So I think this is sort of feeding into their sentiment right now.
Yeah. And I think, you know, that's why maybe the time is right for the Saudi IPO. Now, the reality is if you look out to 2020, nobody's saying that this is going to happen in 2020. It's actually looking to be an oversupply in 2020. Mm-hmm. But longer term, if U.S. tight oil does flatten, then there should, all things the same, be more opportunity for OPEC to grow. But this is the caution. And this was actually in the IHS press release, but didn't really get covered very much. The last two paragraphs talk about at $50, we would think that the production would be flat. But at $65 per barrel oil price, we think that would provide the ability for strong volume growth while also providing meaningful returns to shareholders. So they're saying, oh, well, if the price of oil is $60 or $65, then there would be growth again. And they're talking about the fact that there is ample inventory of high-quality wells out there. You just need the right price to be able to put in the capital needed to grow U.S. oil production again.
Boy, it's a complicated dynamic. I mean, we've got investor sentiment about telling the companies, don't grow your production, grow your profits and give me my money back on one hand. But if you're saying that if the price of oil goes from, say, mid-50s to mid-60s, then all of a sudden there's a different sentiment that might kick in and say, okay, now you've got more money, go drill some more. Is that?
That's right. You'll have more cash flow and now you'll have the ability to not only pay your investors, but have some cash flow left for growth. So it's kind of a bit of a circular thing here, right?
Sure. Like
if there was a case where U.S. supply growth didn't grow very much and it allowed OPEC and Saudi Arabia to produce more, they're probably not going to want to produce it at $50 a barrel. Then the price would go up. That would create the cash flows in the U.S. to allow more production growth than would have been there otherwise.
Yeah. The Saudi Aramco people, I mean, Saudi Aramco is a very well-run company by all accounts, a lot of smart people. It's been that way for a long time. And they understand that there's an optimal oil price. You don't want it too high, because if it goes too high, then it starts to make the price of consumer goods like gasoline too high and you get a demand response. And you don't want it too low, because if it's too low, then you're not making any money. And have been trying to manage the price in a band that is that optimal price.
So the main takeaway here is, yes, U.S. oil production is slowing, but it is all about price.
Well, I think it's a given that it is going to slow. I've seen the rig counts have been falling down.
Yeah, we're down about 20% in terms of rig count.
Getting back again to the original part of the discussion, the service companies are unhealthy at these current levels. They're reporting really poor numbers for Q3.
Yeah, some they're shrinking their inventory.
Some of them are in dire straits. It's not a great situation. So, yeah, production is not going to grow by as much going forward. That's constructive for firmness in oil prices. And now we're seeing Saudi Aramco come out as a public company. It's in their interest to continue to try and be the swing producer as they have been, to try and moderate those prices. So I think that, you know, where it's headed, notwithstanding where demand goes, you're talking at least a fairly optimistic price scenario going forward. And by optimistic, I mean it's not going to come crashing through the floorboards.
Yeah, I would just say one caution is that in 2020, there is a lot of supply growth coming on due to offshore projects that
you're always spoiling the party.
I know. So I think 2020, I mean, that's part of why IHS dropped their price outlook closer to $50
bucks
for the next
Norway,
2 years.
Norway's coming on.
Norway, Guyana, Brazil. Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a lot of offshore supply coming on. And I think that's going to keep the market well supplied, even without a lot of U.S. supply growth. But as we look out beyond the next few years, I think then you will might start
seeing
the markets
sort of tighten
up. And that's why
we're starting to see some of the investment banks and others, the analysts, are starting to say, I'm looking into 2021 to 2023. It looks like, you know, demand is not letting up like everybody talks about in terms of the peak demand. And the amount of money being spent on new replenishment is slowing down. And therefore, there could be a reversion to a tighter market.
Yeah, and I think you're starting to see, I wouldn't say that's the consensus view, but you're starting to see some signs of people having forecasts like that because of this dynamic, because of U.S. title not growing as much. Mm-hmm. So we'll wait and see. There'll be more to talk about on this topic for
There's a lot to talk about. And, you know, historically, we've always called this a cyclical industry. It's still cyclical, but I would say that there's many more dimensions to what controls or what influences the cyclicality. So now we've got this investor dimension. We've got the climate change overlay, the potential for substitution, how much that might be. There's so many variables.
The tight oil dimension.
The tight oil dimension.
Like the fact that price of oil can go up $10 and then suddenly next year you've got a lot more supply than you thought you had. That's a whole new dimension that, you know, we know before we had these big mega projects that took 4 or 5 years and we had a lot of visibility to them.
Right. But the advice really to producers in the space, wherever you are in the world, is you got to make it work at $50 to $60, somewhere in that band. And you have to produce a cleaner carbon barrel of oil.
And give some money back to your investors.
And give some money back to your investors, because they're not going to invest in companies that don't demonstrate cash returns and a better product.
Yeah. And that is more or less the Aramco pitch.
That's the Aramco pitch. And that's why I think it'll be a successful IPO. Although, as we said, it's not clear exactly who will be the buyers in this ESG world.
Okay, good. Well, hey, thanks for listening to the podcast. If you enjoyed this podcast, please rate us on the app that you listen to and tell someone else about us.
For more ideas and insights, visit arcenergyinstitute.com.